Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled The Future of Immigration Law Under the Trump Administration. I'm Becca Miller, AILA's Education Assistant, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Gregory Chen, the AILA Director of Advocacy out of Washington, D.C. Joining Gregory are Marquetta Lint, the AILA Second Vice President in Chicago, Illinois, Ira Kurzban, an AILA past president and author of Kurzban's Immigration Law Sourcebook, 15th edition of Miami, Florida, and David Leopold, also an AILA past president of Cleveland, Ohio. And at this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Gregory.
Thank you very much, and welcome to all of our listeners on this podcast on the future of immigration law under the Trump administration, which has certainly had a lot of action on immigration, perhaps more so than any other topic of domestic interest during the Trump administration's first few months. So the first question that I'm going to ask of our panelists here is, what is Donald Trump's immigration plan? And I'm going to turn first to David. Tell us a little bit about the plan with respect to border and interior.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you talk about his border plan, the first thing that pops up in your head is wall. And we all know recently that Congress refused to fund his wall, but I imagine the president will talk about his wall till he leaves office. So we know about the wall, but let's talk a little bit more substantively. We're talking about expansion of Border Patrol agents, 5,000. He wants money for 5,000 Border Patrol agents, 500 Air and Marine. Again, that's an appropriations issue, which we can talk about later. 287G agreements, now extended to Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol at the border. That's something we haven't seen before. Those are the voluntary agreements with state, local law enforcement, memoranda of understanding. We've seen that with ICE internally. He wants to expand it to Customs and Border Protection. We're going to see some toughening of credible fear interviews. It looks like they're going to be much tougher on credible fear interviews at the border. And I think one of the big ticket items for our practitioners and for their clients is going to be the expansion of expedited removal. Currently, up until the Trump administration, expedited removal for undocumented people was limited to folks who were encountered within 100 miles of the border and who could not show that they were continuously present in the United States for more than 14 days. That's going to be expanded, and that was also drawn out in two subsequent guidance memoranda issued by General Kelly, the Homeland Security, and it's going to be expedited removal for undocumented folks is going to be applied not only at the border, but internally throughout the United States to folks who have not been lawfully admitted and who cannot show a continuous presence in the United States for more than 2 years. So we don't quite know how that's going to play out. Interior, briefly what I'll say, and then we can move on to others, is that we've seen the Trump administration in the first few months gut President Obama's enforcement priorities, which focused on recent border crossers, violent criminals, and national security risks. And suffice it to say that right now, under the current administration, everybody is a priority. While it is couched in terms of criminals, the reality is they're going after grandmothers with the same zeal, probably more so, than they're going after hardened criminals.
Great. Thank you, David, for that very succinct, quick overview of a lot of material. And as if that wasn't enough, and those two border and interior executive orders came only a few days after the president was inaugurated. They came on Wednesday, January 25th. But what actually ended up getting more attention is the topic that Ira is going to address, which is the first travel ban, and then there was another one that came a few weeks later. Ira, will you tell us what happened?
Sure. The first travel ban was issued on January 27, 2017, and as I'm sure all the listeners know, there were injunctions issued. The administration responded by issuing a second travel ban, revoking the first. That's the second travel ban is Executive Order 13780. It was issued on March 6th. and it's in the Federal Register at 82 Federal Register 13209. And two of the most well-known features, obviously, are the ban on six countries. They eliminated Iraq, but they, in a way, put it back in by saying they would still be heightened vetting of people from Iraq, but they eliminated the total 90-day ban. And the second thing is that that has been the subject of litigation is the ban on refugee admissions for 120 days. Those, of course, have gotten a lot of the attention, and they are now the subject of expedited appeals in the Fourth and Ninth Circuit. The district court judge in the Fourth Circuit issued an injunction against the Section 2, which is the ban on the six countries. A second judge in the district court in Hawaii issued a ban on both Section 2 and Section 6, which was the ban on refugees as well. What I wanted to focus on, though, and that will be decided, there's expedited oral argument on May 8th in the Fourth Circuit, expedited oral argument on May 15th in Hawaii versus Trump in the Ninth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit case is IRAC, I-R-A-C, versus Trump. What I wanted to focus on, though, were the other parts of it, which I think are equally pernicious and it will have a much longer lasting effect, which are, among other things, it directs agencies to consider rescinding the trig exemptions under 212D3B. Those are the exemptions for people involving issues of support of terrorism that turned out to be either minor or under duress or so forth. They're now directing agencies to consider rescinding all those trig exemptions. Secondly, they're reviewing all reciprocity agreements under this executive order regarding visa validity. We may see substantial changes in those. Third, there are future bans. In other words, even though they're talking about the 90-day ban of these six countries, the president has directed the Department of Homeland Security in consultation with the Department of State and the Director of National Security to determine whether other countries are providing us sufficient information to allow us to make determinations as to whether or not someone would be a public safety threat. I mean, that could be virtually any country in the world. They've set up a generalized procedure of giving the country 50 days to respond. If they don't, then they would be added to this ban, and the ban has no time limit. Countries like Iran could wind up on a ban permanently. It also directs the data collection as a way of trying to show that foreign nationals are involved in crimes. It says anyone who's been charged or convicted of a terrorism offense, anyone who's been removed for terrorism, anyone, any foreign national radicalized after entry in the U.S. and so forth. They're keeping a data set. And then the other features are in-person interviews for visa applicants will now become the norm. I guess there'll still be certain exceptions, but it's no longer the case that many people who have had visas before will not have to go to another in-person interview. They're setting up uniform standards for screening and vetting, and I'll talk about that in later on, regarding fraud, terrorism, violent extremism, acts of violence toward any group, or risk of harm subsequent to entry. So these screening and vetting procedures will result in, I think, major changes. And finally, it directs the Department of Homeland Security and other departments to finally establish the biometric entry and exit system.
Wow, great. Thank you, Ira, for that detailed walkthrough. Now, if you thought the Trump administration's interests were focused only on people who are, you know, coming into the country or on enforcement issues, you thought wrong. Marketa, will you tell us a little bit more about what has happened with the executive order specifically that came out and, regarding employment issues, and if there's been other play in that area.
Sure, Greg. And as you said, the most dramatic developments so far have been in the enforcement and in the travel ban areas. But there has been also an undercurrent of discussion about the H-1B program, particularly with respect to tech, with the narrative that's being pushed is that the H-1B program is used to bring low-level foreign programmers into the country that displace U.S. workers. And as employers know that use the program and attorneys that use the program, of course, the H-1B does a lot more than that and is very important in a number of other sectors. But this is what the dialogue is about right now politically. And in terms of what the administration has done so far on H-1Bs, as you mentioned, Greg, there's a new executive order that was issued on April the 18th called Presidential Order to Buy American and Hire American. This was the executive order relating to H-1Bs that had been long anticipated, but it's really mostly on government procurement and hiring. But there are two provisions at the end of the executive order relating to H-1Bs. One says that to advance the policies of the administration, the Department of State, Justice, Labor, and Homeland Security shall propose new rules and issue new guidance to protect the interests of U.S. workers in the administration of our immigration system. And then secondly, in order to promote the proper functioning of the H-1B visa program, those agencies shall, as soon as practicable, suggest reforms to help ensure that H-1B visas are awarded to the most skilled or highest paid petition beneficiaries. So there really isn't any immediate impact from these provisions in this executive order. It's essentially directing the agencies to provide recommendations for agency actions and to begin the process to pass regulations to advance these goals. And of course, the president doesn't actually need an executive order to ask his agencies to provide recommendations and start the regulatory process, but apparently the administration thought it was politically important to do so. A couple of other things that have happened. In early April, the USCIS and the Department of Justice issued statements relating to H-1Bs on the same day. The USCIS statement of April the 3rd highlighted its efforts to combat fraud in the H-1B program and announced an expansion of the H-1B site visit program. And on the same day, the Department of Justice issued a statement warning employers not to use the H-1B process to discriminate against U.S. workers and encouraged workers to report discrimination to the Department of Justice. And then just a few days after that, on April 5th, the Department of Labor jumped into the game, also stating that it would use all of its existing authority to initiate investigations of H-1B program violators and said that it would continue to seek to improve the H-1B program to better protect U.S. workers. So a lot of discussion and guidance from the agencies on the H-1B program, particularly with respect to enforcing what it perceives as abuses. And then finally, on the business front, I just want to very quickly mention NAFTA. There's been talk recently from the president about withdrawing from or renegotiating NAFTA, different statements on different days. Obviously, that's a great concern to those holders of TN status and how it might affect them. But I just want to point out, first of all, there's a fairly lengthy withdrawal protocol if a party wants to withdraw from NAFTA. And as we saw recently with the reversals on the position of the administration on NAFTA politically, it's very complicated. And even if the United States as a party withdraws from NAFTA, Congress would still separately have to change the law, as the provisions of NAFTA that relate to TN status were actually separately enacted by Congress. And so even withdrawing from NAFTA as a party would still require Congress to affirmatively change the TN classifications that are in the law.
Great. Thanks, Marketa. And so as Marketa started touching upon, the next subtopic about the administration's immigration plan, I'd like each of you to comment briefly, since we've got a lot of topics to cover. What kind of agency action and congressional action is needed to implement the executive orders and of the White House for these various elements you've just described? But why don't we go back in the order we had before, and David, you want to start with it?
Sure. So on agency action, if you look at both the border memorandum and executive order and the executive order and internal enforcement, There is much of it is ceded to agency control. I mean, there's a good chunk of it, which we'll talk about in a minute, that would require congressional approval and appropriation. But on the border issues, when we talk about expedited removal and the, you know, the changing of the expanse of expedited removal, that is an agency within the discretion of the agency. So the decision to expand the use of it or to use it on a more aggressive basis is really something that they don't need to go to Congress with. So there may be violations, but that's a different issue. So that's by statute. The toughening up of the credible fear interviews of people who are seeking asylum at the border, they are somewhat locked in by statute, but they can, you know, with training or retraining, I suppose that they could interview folks at the border in a different manner with a different emphasis, but they are locked in by statute. The problem there, of course, for many practitioners who handle representation of folks who are applying for asylum at the border, is that, you know, these people come into the United States, many of them from Central America, after a long and arduous trip and danger, and many of them have been victimized and are not really in a position to discuss their credible fear in a way that's coherent, in a way that's cogent, and in a way that may lead to determination of credible fear. So a lot of it, you know, is very frustrating for practitioners and for very dangerous for people who will be applying, because if there isn't that feeling of, if there's a presumption that person is not credible, or, you know, maybe not by statute, but in practice, that could create a sea change in the way these cases are handled by asylum officers at the border. With respect to internal enforcement, I did mention 287G. Again, that's already designated by statute. There may be an appropriations issue, but for the most part, they could expand under the existing law. Within the agency, the ability of CBP, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, to get into 287, a memorandum of understanding with border communities. Whether that happens, we will remain to be seen. But it is within their administrative control. On the internal side, there was part of the internal enforcement memorandum calls for a crackdown, if you will, on sanctuary cities. Of course, many of us lawyers know that there's no legal definition of a sanctuary city. It really is a case-by-case determination as to what that means. For the most part, we're talking about, you know, two situations where they're not, where cities or local jurisdictions are not going to be honoring ICE detainers, which do not have any which are requests. They are not requirements that a local jurisdiction hold somebody for an ICE pickup, and that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So that really, part of that is outside of the federal government's control. The federal government, you know, does have 1373, which is 8 U.S.C. 1373, which is a provision that often you'll hear Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, cite and others to show or to suggest that there are local jurisdictions around the country that are ignoring federal law, which requires them to turn over information. Those of you that have looked at 1373 know that it's actually a very narrow provision of the law, which really has to do with sharing information about the citizenship and immigration status of somebody who's being held in custody. And it's not nearly as broad as the Attorney General suggests that it is. So that is also something that would have to be required to change a statute that's not purely within the administrative powers. One thing that they can do is the enforcement priority, the changing of the enforcement priorities. The Homeland Security Act actually requires that the President set enforcement priorities. President Obama did that. Those enforcement priorities, which were designated by Jay Johnson, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, in November of 2014, which prioritized, I just spoke about those earlier, Those are gone now. Those are archived, and the new enforcement priorities of the mayor, those which are set forth in the executive order on interior enforcement. I won't go over those specifically. Folks can look those up. They're on the president. They're on the White House website. They're also on the AILA website. But basically, they pretty much allow ICE the ability to determine, actually anybody at Homeland Security, the ability to determine that any undocumented person or somebody who may not even be undocumented but who is arguably removable is a priority. So that is administrative, and that's been done. Change in the voice office, there's the Victim of Immigration Crime Engagement Office, that may be subject to some appropriations issues, but I think that it's being funded by existing funds, being taken away from money that was used to assist immigrant victims of crime and others. And for those of you who may not realize what VOICE is, the VOICE office, which was designated in the president's executive order on interior enforcement, is really an office that is designed, at least ostensibly, it's designed to engage with victims of immigrant crime, victims of Americans who have been victimized by quote-unquote illegal aliens. That's their language, not mine. But really, in effect, what it is, it's an office that is there to broadcast the crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. And it actually harkens back to some of the darkest moments of the 20th century in some of the most brutal regimes that similarly broadcasted the crimes committed by discrete groups, minorities. So I'm happy to move on to the legislative stuff later, but I'll let others talk now.
Great. And I'm going to turn it over now to Ira. Any specific thoughts on the agency action or congressional action that would be necessary for the travel ban aspects of the Trump administration's plan to be implemented or come to realization?
Yeah, and I think this is the most frightening aspect of the travel ban itself, which is, it's one thing to make these bellicose executive orders and to, you know, say we're going to ban people for 90 days and so forth. But there are many other ways in which they can prevent people from entering the United States. And I always refer to the fact that during the Depression, you know, the president sent out orders basically reducing immigration into the United States by over 50% by just telling consul officers to slow things down. I think we're going to have unfortunately, a similar situation here. Just by the mere fact of issuing these executive orders, Reuters reported in April that the U.S. issued about 40% less visas to the travel ban countries. It went from 5,700 a month to 3,200 a month. Tillerson on March 23rd ordered embassies to identify populations warranting increased scrutiny as a way, I believe, also of slowing down the process. But the most dramatic thing happened yesterday, which was the notice of information collection. The Department of State is now asking to include the following information in visa applications. This is at 82 Federal Reporter 20956, 82-20956 on May 4th. And they're asking to include now in every visa application the following: the travel history during the last 15 years of the person, including the source of the funds of their travel, a 15-year history of their addresses, a 15-year history of their employment, all passport numbers and country of issuances, names and dates of birth of all siblings, children, current and former spouses, or civil and domestic partners. And here's the most interesting one: all information regarding social media platforms and identifiers, also known as handles, used by the individual in the last 5 years, and then 5 years of phone numbers and emails. They're going to require that this information be provided in all visa applications in the future. Given the number of officers, although they did, you know, give lip service to trying to get more officers appointed, but the reality is, as we all know, just to train people to do this kind of work takes years. So the practical effect will be that given all this special, quote, vetting, that it will dramatically slow down the visa process, even for the simplest cases. One other issue that's arisen is the lawsuit that was filed this week over the Trusted Traveler program. People may be unaware, but in Muslim Advocates versus DHS, they filed a FOIA suit over the government's failure to produce documents regarding the revocation of the Trusted Traveler program to people from the seven nations that they are seeking to ban. So I think you're going to find more litigation on this in the future, and certainly more litigation over visa delays and denials for things like not providing your social media platforms for the last 5 years.
Thank you, Ira. So now, Marketa, your track at what kind of agency action or congressional action is necessary to effectuate the Trump administration's plans on employment benefits areas?
Well, with respect to business immigration, what the agencies have said, as I'd mentioned earlier, that has had really any direct impact is the expansion of enforcement of the H-1B program and some of the other fraud provisions, and increased enforcement of the law obviously does, or increased enforcement doesn't need any changes in the law or in the regulations, although it does mean more money or a shift of enforcement resources from other areas to these areas within the agencies. But there's been along the way some interesting discussion about possible changes in H-1B, and of course the administration has asked the agencies to suggest reforms in this area. One has been a discussion of changes to the way that the H-1B lottery works, and this is a really interesting question. The law says that the agency has to accept all CAP subject H-1Bs that are filed in the first 5 business days, and that if those exceed the annual limit, that it, quote, may conduct a lottery, presumably as opposed to accepting them in the order in which they were received. And so it's an interesting question as to how changes in the way that lottery works, how they would happen and what they would require. The agency obviously has some discretion about the mechanics of how the lottery is administered, and for example, this year it suspended premium processing, but changes such as prioritizing certain filings in the lottery based on characteristics of the employer or the type of job or the wage level, I don't think that that could be done even by regulation, but would require a change in the law. And there are a number of different places where the administration could look at making regulatory changes, some of the details on wage levels, how wages need to be paid, prevailing wage determinations, and so on are defined in the DOL regulations, and obviously the agency could look at changing those. And then there are interpretations that as business practitioners that we practice under, such as what constitutes a specialty occupation and some of the different concepts within that. To some extent, those are within the discretion of the agency, although, of course, as long as we have the same regulations, those interpretations are also governed by years of administrative case law that's already on the book. So, again, even with some of these interpretations, for them to change, it would require regulatory change. And other changes discussed in the H-1B program requiring, for example, higher wage levels or educational levels or labor market tests, those seem to me that they would require legislative change. And if the administration tries to impose changes like this through agency action or even through regulations, especially where it would affect the ability of certain types of employers to qualify for H-1B visas, I think the administration needs to expect that employers will file litigation challenging such rules as being outside of its authority.
Thank you, Marketa. So we're going to shift over now to the legislative side of things. And I'll just start by saying that AILA has supported broad reforms to the immigration system in several different categories. We supported the 2013 bill that was a comprehensive immigration reform bill. The Trump administration has not signaled yet what kind of broader solutions they plan to introduce vis-a-vis legislation. So far, most of the actions really have been targeted on the executive side, and he has not talked about what legislative agenda he has. With that being said, there was focus and interest on what kind of policy he would take with respect to Dreamers, and specifically the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival initiative. David, can you tell us a little bit about the DREAM Act and also the BRIDGE Act, kind of a related bill, and what action we've seen and hope to see on those?
Sure. Well, the DREAM Act, as many people know, was introduced many years ago. It hasn't been, it failed in 2010 and has not been reintroduced, as far as I know, this Congress or last few Congresses. The Dream Act, as written, does provide a pathway to citizenship for a discrete group of undocumented youth, pretty much mirroring those who did in the end qualify for DACA. But it is not on the table to be passed anytime soon or even introduced. What we do have, what was introduced, is BRIDGE, which you mentioned, the BRIDGE Act. And that was introduced early on, early this year, on a bipartisan basis by Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Dick Durbin of Illinois. Dick Durbin, by the way, was one of the great champions of Dreamers and the Dream Act, along with some other senators, five others, I believe. And they did introduce this, and a very similar piece of legislation was introduced in the House of Representatives by Mike Kaufman and seven other House members. Basically, what BRIDGE does is it codifies DACA. The requirements for BRIDGE are very similar to DACA, the age requirement of being 15 years old when the person was born. I think the BRIDGE Act says they have to have been born after June 15th, 81, have to have come to the U.S. before their 16th birthday and been here continuously since June 15th, 2007. So very similar to DACA. And it would provide and also some of the exclusions are the same, significant misdemeanors, et cetera, et cetera. It would provide a three-year status, but it would not provide a pathway to citizenship. So in that way, it is very limited, and it does differ from DREAM, which, as I said earlier, does provide a pathway to citizenship. So what this is really meant to be is a stopgap, and I think what it would do, the protection that it offers that DACA doesn't, is it's codified. It's not a matter of guidance memoranda that couldn't be pulled by the president. And as many folks listening today know, that people who represent DACA minted clients, people with DACA, everybody's biting their nails, wondering if a new executive order is going to come out pulling DACA or a new memorandum is going to come out pulling DACA. That hasn't happened yet, at least as of today. But the BRIDGE Act, if that were in place, would alleviate that anxiety, at least for the time being. This would be granted in three-year increments. So that's the BRIDGE Act, and that's where we stand now. And by the way, the BRIDGE Act, as I understand it, Greg, is not moving anywhere in Congress. It hasn't been in the last several weeks.
Great. Thanks, David. I'm going to shift over now to Marketa. And a bill that AILA has long supported that's been a bipartisan effort on high skill issues is the I-squared bill that Orrin Hatch of Utah has long been the lead on. Can you tell us a little bit about I-squared?
Sure. It's an interesting bill because it tries to address the problems that employers have with the uncertainty of the H-1B cap and the lottery by increasing the numbers. It also has provisions to make the H-1B program more responsive to the need for certain jobs in our economy, especially in the STEM areas. And it also seeks to balance that with a way to address some of the criticisms of the H-1B program, especially with respect to the displacement of U.S. workers. So what the bill would do is, first of all, it does increase the numbers, but it combines the numbers into one cap, so there would be no more master's cap. It combines it into one cap of 115,000, And then what's interesting is then there is a market adjustment if the cap is hit within a certain amount of time that goes through sort of a step process that would allow the cap to go up to a total of 195,000 H-1B cap numbers, again, depending on when the cap is hit and so on. It allows USCIS to prioritize filings, but it does provide legislative direction on how those would be prioritized. And the first category would be for people who have STEM bachelor's that were earned in the U.S. The second category would be other types of bachelor's degrees earned in the U.S. And then the third would be all others. And then, of course, the master's, again, are collapsed into that. So it would prioritize it with a focus on STEM degrees and U.S. earned degrees. There are also provisions in it that would preserve unused cap numbers, meaning unused numbers for cases that were selected to prevent the flooding of the system by certain users that file a lot of H-1Bs and then never use them. So it would, again, provide for ways to allow those numbers to be returned, and also it would include a reporting requirement to ensure that companies that are using the H-1B system are actually using those H-1B visas for workers. And then it would also prohibit employers who have the intent of replacing U.S. workers with H-1Bs. There are provisions related to that, and there's a portion of it that addresses specifically contractors, and there's a piece of it that addresses employers that use contractors to provide them with employees to, again, address those criticisms of the displacement of U.S. workers. And then there's a number of other provisions that I won't go through, but I'll just summarize them by saying that some of them would codify some of the statutory and practice provisions that a lot of us rely on, the 60-day grace period, deference to prior approvals, and a few other things, including work authorization for dependents of H-1Bs that would be codified.
Thank you, Marketa. And now there are a few other programs that periodically come up for reauthorization, the EB-5 program, Conrad 30, and the Religious Worker program, as well as E-Verify. Those were actually all reauthorized in this past supplemental and continuing resolution bill to fund the federal government. That just happened literally on May 4th. That was one day before we recorded this podcast. Ira, can you just tell us a little bit more about those programs and kind of where those stand and moving forward, what we are expecting?
Well, given the time, I think most people know about these since they've been continued. Greg can, over years now. The EB-5 program is the Immigrant Investor Program. There are many bills now, many versions of different bills pending on EB-5. Conrad is the Conrad 30 program that provides waivers for doctors working in medically underserved areas. The religious worker provision applies not to persons who are priests or rabbis or ministers, but to other religious workers. That's been extended now until September 30th, and E-Verify, which I think is a major project for Republicans in Congress, again, has also been extended, and I would expect some more action, particularly on EB-5 by September, but, it's always up in the air. The one bill I did want to mention really quickly is H.R. 1036, which is something Greg, you and I had worked on in different forms in the original Senate bill. It's a bill that provides for waivers, broad waivers for virtually everything in terms of waivers that may be needed in the context of removal proceedings. It's a bipartisan bill. There are five Republicans that have already signed on to it. I would suggest people take a look at that, urge their members to join it, and particularly Republicans. I think it's one of those few kinds of bills that has a chance of passing because it's really a matter of fairness. It would change the lack of a waiver, for example, for false claims to U.S. citizenship And would broaden waivers under 212H and 212I by having a more generalized waiver in the public interest. So to the extent that I think we can do something, that's one of the bills I would focus attention on.
Great. Thank you, Ira. The last comment that I'll just make legislatively is on the H-2B issue. And AILA has supported reinstating a particular exemption for returning workers on the H-2B program. That exemption had been included in past bills and legislation. It does not currently function. It was not renewed last year, so we've been asking that it be renewed. What the exemption does is to exempt an H-2B worker from the current fiscal year's cap if that worker has been issued an H-2B visa during the previous 3 years. And we pushed for it to be included in the spending bill that just passed in early May. We weren't able to get it in, but the bill does include a more limited provision that could allow DHS, in consultation with the Department of Labor, to increase the H-2B cap and provide that limited relief. But it only will come into effect, it's only triggered, if the two agencies determine that there aren't sufficient U.S. workers who are able to fill the available positions. So we're going to look forward to seeing how that actually gets implemented. The last issue that we wanted to cover is just what AILA is doing in response to what has happened administratively with the President's announcements and plans on immigration. I will start that, and then I will turn it over to Marketa if she wants to add anything as a leader on our executive committee nationally. I will begin by saying that shortly after the elections, the amount of response that came both from AILA's membership as well as immigrant communities and non-AILA member lawyers was overwhelming. A great deal of interest about people engaging on immigration issues, lots of expressions of interest to do pro bono work and to assist, largely I would say on the side of assisting and protecting people who might face enforcement or removal. AILA's national office has kicked off a program called the Justice Campaign to work jointly with the American Immigration Council and other organizations on the ground. It's partly a pro bono effort to train people to pick up cases, but it's also an effort to lift up the practice of immigration law to essentially make us much more robust in our efforts to defend those who are facing removal. So keep your eyes peeled for more information. It's on our website now for the Justice Campaign. We've also been working tirelessly to provide information to our members and to the public about the policy changes as well as the legislative developments. We hope that all of you will continue to look at those materials. At the local level, we've had many chapters and members become more involved and engaged, both at the national level for national policy changes, but also at the local level with movements such as looking at whether or not laws are being passed that will hurt immigrants in their various states. And, for example, right now we're engaged in an effort to fend off a bill called SB4 in Texas that would punish communities that try to have more protective policies to ensure public safety is maintained and that their local police not become immigration agencies at that level. I'm going to stop there and just turn it over to Marketa to see if you had any other further thoughts with respect to the national leadership perspective for how AILA is responding.
Sure. So I think these are obviously really difficult and really stressful times for our clients and also for many of us, both as lawyers and individuals. And I would absolutely echo, Greg, what you said. It's just been amazing to see how many people in AILA and all over the country have stepped up. And I think you covered a lot of what the national office has been involved in. I mean, honestly, I don't know how you guys have a chance to sleep with all the work that you're doing. It's just, you've just been doing terrific work. And in addition to what you mentioned in terms of keeping abreast of changes and informing members and developing materials, I think just a couple of other things I'd want to add is the work that both the national staff and the national liaison committees are doing to support all of the national and local liaison committees and the work that they do, both in addressing the new issues that are coming up through the new implementation and the new guidance that's coming out of the administration, and also all the work that's being done to try to preserve our important liaison relationships in a difficult time like this, and also all the work that's being done around messaging and media and to get our leadership on TV and in the press and to get our message out that that immigration is good for America and that this dark view of immigrants is not right and it's not in our economic interest and it doesn't represent the values of our country. I also just want to quickly say our professionalism staff is working to fight the spread of unauthorized practice of law, which sadly at times like these when people are afraid and desperate proliferates, and we're doing work in that area as well. And then the work that's being done at the chapter level is just really amazing. I mean, chapters are doing all kinds of different things depending on what they're seeing as the issues in their area, creating local response teams. Members are doing countless presentations in churches, synagogues, mosques, community centers, their Monday night book clubs, anywhere that you can think of where people are coming together to try to educate their communities. A lot of communities are doing work advocating for local sanctuary city, welcoming city ordinances, and some of those have been successful, and those are great victories at times like this. And then our Bar's pro bono efforts and justice campaign, which you mentioned, Greg, where we're working with the council and other allies to really try to harness the amazing energy that's been built up in response to this crisis. So it's been a really difficult time, but there's just so much great work going on, and I have just never been more proud of AILA staff and leadership and chapters and members at all the really amazing work that we're seeing all over the country.
Thank you, Marketa, for those very kind and positive marks about all the efforts that AILA has done, not just the national staff, but also across the country, all our members. I'm going to, as we bring things to a close, do a quick round with all three of you just to see if you have any final remarks, any final comments of things that we didn't touch upon before. So why don't we just go in the order that we began. David, what kind of final concluding remarks would you like to share?
Thanks, Greg, and thanks to Marketa and to Ira. It's been a pleasure to be here with you guys today. Look, I think that now is a time, you know, we are practicing lawyers. Most of us are professors at AILA, but this just isn't about practice or teaching anymore. This is about our country. This is bigger than immigration. This is bigger than our issues. This is about the future of the country, and we are in a very dangerous situation right now, both with our issue and in larger perspective. And I think I would challenge, and Marketa laid out the amazing work that the members are doing. We've got to keep that up. I think this is a time to think outside the box. This is a time where, you know, you are going to make, you've got to make a difference. We've all got to make a difference. And this is about saving the democracy in which we live. So our mission as an association is to make the law better. Our mission is to make the practice better. And let's do that. And let's also preserve and protect our Constitution.
Thank you, David. And now how about Ira, final remarks? You might be muted.
I think we need to fight these travel bans, the enforcement issues, the kinds of things that we've heard about on all levels, which means people need to go into removal proceedings with the attitude that they're going to challenge everything that the government does. I don't think the days of conceding things are an appropriate response to what we're now seeing on that level or before ICE. I think people should think more about litigating, suing the government. And I think we need to think much more creatively about finding friends in Congress who can make a lot of noise about the issues that we care about.
Great. Thank you, Ira. And lastly, for cleanup, Marketa, final remarks.
Well, I agree with what David and Ira said, and I think that we've seen in the last several months that pushing back on some of these efforts and on some of these orders works when people come together and do it. And I think it's very important, as both of the other two speakers have said, that we continue to do that and we try to do that creatively and differently and in new ways to respond to a new environment. I think as a business practitioner, I'm seeing more businesses getting more interested and involved in these issues. Their employees are extremely anxious, and more businesses than I've seen in the past are stepping up and are interested in seeing what the values of our country are and the values of their workforces and the values of all of us. And so I think there's room for creative alliances and ways to step up and do what's right.
Well, thank you to all three of you. I mean, it goes without saying that we have our work cut out for us. And in that respect, you know, perhaps I would venture to say that the role of AILA has never been more important, as immigration has just risen to such a level of national prominence under this administration. So I'm looking forward to working with all three of you. And for all the listeners, this will be concluding our podcast. We appreciate your joining us. And thank you again.